You're listening to KURU 89.1 on your FM dial, GMCR.org on the World Wide Web, Gila Members Community Radio in Silver City, New Mexico. Thanks for joining me this morning on Tuesday Morning Beat. My name's Mary McHugh, and I'll be your host. And as promised, we are having our segment of Tuesday Morning Beat, which is Beyond the Border, conversation about death and dying, many aspects of this journey. And my guests today, I'm so happy to say good morning to Adrian Dare.
Good morning.
Yes, I'm so glad you're here. Adrian is a PhD, a retired university professor who has been a resident of Silver City since 1986.
I love it here.
In 2002, she traveled to Oregon to be with her mom, who had terminal cancer, and was able to take advantage of Oregon's Death with Dignity Act. Since then, she has been passionate about medical aid in dying as an end-of-life option in New Mexico. Since 2012, Adrian has been active around the state, giving presentations about end-of-life options and working to finally see New Mexico become the 11th jurisdiction in the United States to allow medical aid in dying. Currently, Adrian is a member of End-of-Life Options New Mexico, a nonprofit organization created to help implement the new law. And she's been here for a while. We mentioned she's been here since 86. And when she came for a job at Western New Mexico University teaching math and computer science, she retired from teaching in 2001. Adrian's other passions include encouraging girls in STEM careers. And in 1993, she started Expanding Your Horizon conferences for girls 5th to 8th grades, which she ran on the Western New Mexico University campus for more than 30 years. Wow, that must have been so much fun. And Scott Plate, he will moderate our conversation today. Scott and I are co-producers of Beyond the Border, and I'm just so glad to have this affiliation with you, Scott.
Thank you. Me too.
Scott is a pathfinder who helps to catalyze consciousness. All right. We need to talk about that someday. He is the co-founder of Native Heartseed, a certified life coach, a trained death doula, and a published writer. He has decades of experience as expressive therapist, educator, actor, and director. His students and clients work at the highest levels of the entertainment industry, and as fine artists, counselors, clinicians, educators, and clergy. And I welcome you to Tuesday Morning Beat.
Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. And hi, Adrian.
Hi.
Yeah.
It's good to be here with you. Okay. So, Adrian, first of all, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I'm passionate here about this issue.
So. I know you are. And you were the very first guest we wanted to have on this show because you are in so many ways a trailblazer in our state. Because it's worth noting that when you traveled to Oregon in 2002 to help your mother, that was the only state in the union at that time to have medical assistance in dying.
Right.
So at that point, you know, in my own history, I was facing a terminal illness or the possibility of inheriting a gene. And my plan was to travel to Oregon if the diagnosis or if I found out to inherit the gene. So it was good to know, even way back 22, 23 years ago, that there was a place I could do that. So I've got some questions I wanted to ask you because your journey to this has been so unique and so interesting and really so personal. And part of the program, what we hope to accomplish is to get people talking about how this became a passion for them, really. So when did you first become aware of death as a reality in life?
Well, I didn't have much experience with death growing up. The first time I remember anything at all about death was in college. I learned that a friend I had in high school had died, and that was the first time I even thought about it, and I didn't really know her that well. And the only other time was later on in my life. I can remember when thinking about my parents dying, and I couldn't conceive of how I could endure that. And it wasn't until my mid-50s that I experienced death of my husband's parents, and my father died in 1998, his case was interesting. We went up to visit them because we knew he had
congestive heart failure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he didn't realize he was dying.
Mm.
And a week later, he was dead. So
that was,
you know,
sudden.
At least he didn't suffer
mm-hmm.
that much.
But you did. Yeah.
But my mother's situation in 2002, she was suffering. Mm. She had pain, and she was on pain medication, and that she didn't like that because she couldn't read as much. Mm. I mean, she used to like to read, and that made it difficult. And mm-hmm. I remember her hallucinating. And she used to joke about being DUI because my parents didn't drink and mm-hmm. anything. And
they weren't big fans of impairment of any kind, right?
So, having that experience, it was a positive experience.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was there for the last two months of her life, and she was actually getting some radiation treatment, but that became something that she didn't want to do because she was in so much pain.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually, we were able to contact George Amy, who was working with Death Compassion and Dying at the time, and we talked to him, and my mother talked to him, and we arranged for volunteers to come down, and so we didn't have to do anything. They brought the drugs with them, and it was just really interesting. The night before she died, we knew when she was going to die, September 5th. And the night before, I stayed at her bedside all night long. And one time I put my head down on her bed. And I can still hear her saying, "Adrian, don't cry. I'm all right."
Hmm.
And later on, I heard her mumbling something about death.
Hmm.
And in the morning, she took the anti-nausea medicine. And then the volunteers came. She was living in a sort of an assisted living place, and her sister was also there. Her sister was six years younger, and her sister had cancer and Parkinson's, or you know, she was in the nursing home, and she died in December. And so my mother was the last one of her family. And she had a lot of pain,
mm-hmm.
and they kept increasing the medication. And my sister-in-law, well, my sister-in-law and my brother were there, and the two volunteers and the minister came. And my sister-in-law said, "Thank you for giving me Tim," and she said, "Thanks for taking him."
Thanks for taking him off my hands. Right.
The minister came. Well, yeah, she came a little bit late, but she came and she said, "Ask my mom if she wanted a prayer." Now, my mother was born in China. Her parents were missionaries, and so the Methodist Church was always important to them, and that was a big part of their life. And my mom said no. She just wanted to get this done because she was ready to die.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like I say, it's a positive thing. I miss her. I didn't want her to leave, but she was no longer in pain.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what started my journey. And that's when I started exploring things and hearing about stories of people that wanted to die and they couldn't. And then stories about where maybe a couple would be together and the spouse would not be helping but just be there to comfort them, but they'd still get maybe arrested, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been heavily involved in this issue for 22 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I got involved in the state in 2012, and I didn't understand how they knew me. It was Compassion and Choices.
Mm-hmm.
I finally learned many years later that it was George Amy who was the person we talked to in Oregon in 2002. And he was also, I think he's retired now. He was also at the head of Death with Dignity organization after he was with Compassion and Choices. But every anniversary of my mother's death, I'd send him a thank you. And I can't remember how I found out that he was the one that gave them the information, because I was just surprised. In February 2012, I got an email asking me if I wanted to be involved in a court case. And so we actually took it to the court in San Bernardino, and we actually won the case, but there was an appeal. Mm-hmm. And so I even saw that we were said to have medical aid in dying in New Mexico for a while, but we never did, but... But finally, we went to the New Mexico Supreme Court, and they told us we needed to take to legislation.
For our listeners' benefit, Death with Dignity was an organization that emerged on a national scale in the 1990s. And then Compassion and Choices is a wonderful resource for people. These are organizations that Adrian has mentioned. Wonderful resource for people who are interested in preparing end-of-life documentation, just becoming aware of the options that are available, as is End of Life Options New Mexico, which is the organization that you represent right now. What I'm interested in is, first of all, thank you for that context in the story. What awoke in you? What did death or dealing with your mom's death awake in you so that you could do what you do now?
Well, just passion. I mean, I became passionate about it. As you said, I was always a very shy person, afraid to raise my hand in class, and never volunteered anything, mm-hmm. and didn't like to make phone calls, all that. And that's what drove me to it. That's what also drove me to getting involved with Expanding Your Horizons conferences for girls, because here I was a woman, and I've got a PhD in math and a master's in computer science, and I was the only one.
Mm-hmm.
And
I was watching you talk about your mom, and just a few moments ago, and you're talking about them giving her, increasing her pain medication, and your face kind of went, ugh. Was it something about that process of just cranking up the medication that made you think there's got to be a different way?
I don't know. I knew she just wasn't.
You knew her.
She was not happy. She was not happy. And, well, like I say, they didn't even drink. And so being under the influence of these drugs was...
Heavy sedation, yeah.
Yeah. And they kept increasing it. And so it was a relief that she was no longer in pain.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Whereas my father, I thought that was very interesting, because we went up to Colorado, and we went to the doctors, because he had been going to emergency to keep getting drained.
Mm-hmm.
And after he saw the doctor said, the doctor thinks I'm on my last legs. And a week later. One of the things nowadays, I'm trying to have people learn how to talk about death. Apparently, they never consider it. The doctor didn't talk about it. Of course, they don't. They still don't. Doctors still don't necessarily bring that up. I don't know. But that's something that needs to be done.
Yeah, it's challenging. Yeah, there's some work to be done there.
Mm-hmm.
So, Adrian, so many questions come up, as a result of listening to the example of your life story. One that pops up is, tell me what it felt like. From the point of view of someone who didn't really have a close relationship with death, that didn't really show up in your life until later on, what have you learned about death since death has shown up in your life? What have you learned about it?
Well, it shouldn't be something that you're afraid of. We know everybody's going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And what I see is that more and more people are learning to talk about death. And when I see people, I've seen videos where a family is talking together, and the grandfather, they're worried about the grandfather who maybe has a problem but is still healthy, relatively healthy and happy. Mm-hmm. And the grandson talks about him giving up, and that's not what he's doing. He's he's realistic. He knows he's going to die someday, and he's had a good life, and he's thankful for it. And, you know, unfortunately, it shouldn't be something that people are afraid of.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think we are? In your experience.
Because we don't talk about it, basically. If we don't know what's going to happen or have an idea.
It's the unknown.
Yeah, it's the unknown. And so
I think the advice of a shy person is actually pretty important here. Because for some people who are shy, talking about anything is unimaginable.
My mother was surprised I could get up in front of a class and talk.
So from the point of view of a shy person who learned to roar, for lack of a better way of saying it, how would you counsel someone who is afraid to talk about death to begin to broach that topic?
Well, it's hard to say because I'm so shy. I don't know. I mean, like with helping girls with with science and math and death, these are two things that I just seem to be very passionate about, and that's what drives me. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to talk about these things.
So you just couldn't keep quiet anymore?
Right.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. So in terms of, can you talk a little bit more about what your current role is? Like, we're a little bit more about what you do with End of Life Options New Mexico, because this is, this relationship with death has matured in this way, and this is how I got to know you, you know, working as
you
one
want
of
me
your
to
volunteers.
Talk about getting the law?
Mm-hmm. That'd be great.
Oh, yeah.
And how the whole organization was born.
Okay, in 2012 is when I got the invitation to be in this trial, and some of the people I'm working with now were involved back then, and so some of these people I've known for a long time, and we had the trial. As I said, we didn't pass it. The New Mexico Supreme Court told us we needed to take it to legislation. So in 2017, we took it to the legislation. And I think we lost something by two votes. So we didn't get it passed then. In 2019, that was a very difficult year. It seemed kind of nasty. There was an issue about abortion that was being brought up, and also the end of life options. And so T-shirts were made from the opposition with a list of things they didn't like on the back, and one of them was killing grandma and one was killing babies. That was their attitude. And that was just a bad year. We did not. So after that happened, we did a lot of work with the legislatures. I had teams of people writing letters and communicating, and we've got volunteers around the state doing this. And I think one reason we're so successful is we've been doing a lot of work with institutions and with the population for a long time. And so by 2021, I can say one good result of COVID was Zoom. Because without Zoom, I couldn't have done this, because I could even make comments in the legislation from home. And I have meetings from people in my group around the state. And so that was a big help. So in 2021, we finally passed the bill. And
that's amazing.
That's when we, I think after when the governor signed the bill, that's when we started implementing a new nonprofit, the End of Life Options New Mexico. And so it took a long time to get the 501(c), but we did get it, and it's my family. Mm. I've been working with these people for so long, and like I say, I feel like they're my family because I'm so involved in this. And they're, like I say, there are people around the state, mostly volunteers. We're all volunteers. In fact, I have a meeting this afternoon with EOLONM regarding strategy. That we had a strategy meeting, so, you know, and it's a great group of people to work with. We've got dedicated people, and as I said, we've got lots of volunteers around the state, and a lot of these volunteers are people who have involvement with death, like a death doula, hospice nurses, or people that have volunteered for hospice.
Mary is a nurse practitioner.
Yeah,
exactly.
I'm the exception. I was just a math computer science teacher. So I have
but a really fantastic abilities to organize and engage, and you've stayed with it for so long. I mean, you really have, you have your boots on the ground. I mean, you are firmly planted in this journey, this End of Life Options New Mexico. Your vibrant engagement is contagious. You're really holding a lot together in this community, and
really
I'm so appreciate that.
About all the people we've had, that meeting we had the other day with, 12 of 14 people were there, and it's just wonderful. And I'm hoping what I want, since I've been doing this so long, I need people to help out and maybe take more responsibility. I'm interested in people doing tabling events and doing presentations, so I want to work on getting people to do that.
Well, I think that's what's nice is, I mean, and you, on the show you'll get to meet some of those 12 to 14 people that were around the table that day, little by little, people who have been working with Adrienne for a long time and listening to their perspectives and why they became involved and what their passion is and how they hope to change and enrich the conversation. But it's, I think it's important that we get as many perspectives as we can, because that's a conversation that feels inclusive and open. So what are the biggest challenges you have now with End of Life Options New Mexico? How would you like, what sorts of resources would you like to see develop so that this continues to grow?
Well, as far as the organization, we're considering maybe hiring more people to help, because Julia can't do as much as she's.
And Julia is.
She's the executive director.
In
we have
Albuquerque?
Two people that are paid. No, well.
On Zoom.
I think she lives in Santa Fe.
Okay.
I mean,
she lives in Zoomland.
Zoomland, yeah.
Yeah, right. They're all in Zoomland.
They're all in Zoomland, yeah.
In fact, I'd worked the previous person that was there that retired. I had seen her in a little box for years. Mm-hmm. And so when she retired, there was a surprise retirement party that her daughter was organizing. So I decided I had to go. And so I finally got to see her in person.
There's a website for End of Life Options New Mexico. You say you need more people to be engaged, and you need more volunteers. So for our listeners, that would be End of Life Options New Mexico.
Well, it's End of Life Options NM.org.
Okay.
All written out.
And there are lots of ways to be involved. I think it's important for people to understand. Adrienne is often at any public event, such as gatherings for the 4th of July, for Give Grandly, for Silver City Pride in the past.
Earth Day.
Yeah. Around the county.
Fairs,
Members Health Fair. It's a way to have a presence in the broader community and to engage people in conversation who would like to come up and have questions about it. Now, for some people, they're difficult conversations, but the important thing is that there's a smiling face that's informed on the other end of the table, willing to answer those questions. There are client service volunteers, people who are directly serving people who are nearing the end of their life. There are people who are presenters. You know, for example, I've served in that capacity with you a few times, working with Will, Western Institute for Lifelong Learning, presenting End of Life Options, like a seminar over three different, like a 6-hour seminar over 3 weeks, just getting the word out about how people might approach the issue and have the conversation. And it moves from the very, very, the letter of it, how to get prepared, to the spiritual aspect of it, if that's what's important to you, how to prepare yourself as a human being. Do you feel that people have a right to die the way they want?
Yes, I do.
Okay. What are their rights, do you think? What do you think a human right is?
I think they have a right. I believe they have a right to end their life if when they're ready. You know, that's a touchy subject.
Mm-hmm.
But our laws in this country are more strict than other laws that have options for people. The requirement for medically dying, for example, is you have to be an adult, which means 18 or older. You have to be a resident, but that doesn't seem to be a serious problem, and a couple of states now have already changed it so that you don't have to be a resident. But we do have people coming here that are from out of state, and all they need is an address. And
where
so
there
that
are no
hasn't,
laws that protect
that hasn't
them,
been a
right?
big, mm-hmm. big problem.
Right.
So they have to be able to self-administer the medication, and that means often drinking it. But if people can't drink it, it can be inserted into a feeding tube or a rectal tube. So that means if a person is totally paralyzed, what do they do? I mean, when
That's
people
why
are
planning
dying,
is so important.
Yeah, when people are dying, sometimes they can't function very well. And so that's a restriction. But it's amazing how creative people can do to try to get it done. And you have to also, well, you have to be terminally ill.
Yes. Terminally ill, mentally capable, with a prognosis of 6 months or less to live. Like you say, self-administer. Mm-hmm. And it requires two medical providers. In this state, we need a medical doctor or a DO to make the decision. And then a second opinion is required, but the second opinion can come from a nurse practitioner or a PA.
And that's one of the things that I'm so proud of New Mexico. We are the first ones to initiate that option where one of the providers does not have to be a physician or a DO.
Yeah. There's a lot of checks and balances in how MAID, Medical Assistance in Dying, known as MAID, there's a lot of checks and balances. There's a very strict criteria to be a candidate for this. And when we talk about end-of-life options, it's not just drinking the elixir, the end-of-life ingestion of the medications that once you drink it, that's it. There's no going back. But there are other options as well. So when we talk about end-of-life options, it's not always someone has decided that they're going to drink the elixir of death. There's other ways to support the dying process. And that's what I like about End of Life Options New Mexico in particular, is because there's a broad spectrum of awareness. And that's what people need, so that when they're fearful and they're uncertain, what are my options? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, I can't make this choice for you, but I can give you the information so that you can make an informed choice and the best choice for you. And I think that's really a strong point of this group.
I think that's the most important way to start a conversation, is to let people know that their viewpoint, even if they haven't formed it fully, it's okay for them to explore it here among people who have dealt with this on their own. So I'm just interested in your story, as coming from someone who was reticent to speak, reticent to advocate, presented with circumstances that put you in that position, to being an advocate for basically an entire state of people, getting a law across, and not just once or twice or three times. I think there were a few attempts that did not make it across the finish line, but getting it
going
all the way across. So there's some fortitude there. So to me, that does speak to passion. That does speak to your belief in the person's right to die. Have they met these criteria? We hear a lot about right to life, and I'm interested in this idea of a right to death. We have rights when it comes to death. Do you feel as though we have a right to die?
I do, yes. And one of the restrictions is for medical-aid and dying. Again, medical-aid and dying is only one choice, is that you have to be terminal.
Right.
And a person can be done with life because of various things, reasons, without having a terminal diagnosis. And so
right.
So that's a problem. As I say, we have a stricter law than other places. For Canada, for example, is much more liberal in that they have what they call medical aid in dying, and there's the option of ingesting the medication or euthanasia, having the doctor inject you. And apparently most people that use it have the doctor's help, which is in a way safer. But
it doesn't taste as bad.
Yeah. Right. And also another restriction is the restriction of 6 months or less to live. if a person doesn't have that diagnosis, they're not eligible here. But I think in Canada, they can be. In fact, when we first wrote the bill, we didn't specify 6 months or less. We said something more broad, but we changed it to be 6 months or less so that we could pass the bill.
Mm-hmm. Compromises along the way.
Yeah.
What do you think is necessary now to broaden access to this? For example, I think Canada is an example. I mean, even though New Mexico's law is among the more progressive in the U.S., in the U.S., we are among the most restrictive laws about this in the world.
Right.
So what do you think is necessary now in order to, I don't want to say push the envelope so much as to broaden access to this, for example, to include neurological suffering, people who have mental illness, and, you know, what's your sense of that, having gone through the trenches with this?
Well, change takes a long time. We actually, the first attempt in New Mexico that I didn't know about was back in 95, over 25 years or so for us to get it, and it takes a long time.
Mm.
And
so patience.
But part of the reason is the Catholic Church, which is opposed to it, and they run a lot of hospitals. I know in Washington State there's a problem because there's so many hospitals that will not allow it or won't talk about it. There was one report where talking about, I don't know if this is, oh, I know, they were comparing Canada with California, which are about the same size. Only 25% of the people in California knew about medical aid in dying, whereas in Canada, 70 or something percent. And partly the medical system supports it there. So it just takes a long time for people to change.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look at other social issues have just taken a long time to.
In your observation of the tracking this law from the first failed attempts to getting it across to the final successful attempt, what changed in New Mexico?
Well, maybe we're just better people.
I think in a sense there's a live and let live quality about politics in New Mexico here that, you know, not everyone would agree with that. But I'm interested in your perspective of watching what shifted so that this is possible, because you got to see it from no to yes, you know, and so it became a right. It became a protected right. And this is, you know, we're talking on the show about death as a social justice issue in more ways than one. So you have probably the bird's eye view of how this goes, you know. So what?
I know I've seen through the years, like I think the first year I did a tabling event at the Members Health Fair, may have been 2013.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I'm doing every year except a couple years during COVID.
Mm-hmm.
And also giving presentations during that time, and at the fair, for example, I've seen year by year more and more people understand or have heard about medical aid in dying. And I know the last two tabling events we did, it was really fun and exciting because people were not afraid to stop at the table because it says end of life options.
Mm-hmm.
So I've seen a but we are a more progressive community too, so.
Mm-hmm. Although for a while we weren't. I mean, we didn't lose by much, a couple of votes there. I guess the interesting thing that keeps popping up in my mind is laws ultimately are drafted in this country in order to protect what people perceive as rights. In many cases, very often they're, you know, that's not the reason why they're drafted. But in our country, very often that's what happens. So were you able to perceive a shift in people's perspective of this is the right thing to do, we need to do this because it's the right thing to do? Or was it just kind of coincidence and the people who were in the seats those days, and how did it work out?
I think sometimes it's just people having experience with a loved one that is dying, and they, you know, maybe they were against it, but then they have a relative that's suffering, and then they become aware.
It's not necessarily dinner conversation. People have to feel safe in order to talk about it. If we're talking about the right to die, I think we have the right, everyone will die, and we have the right to choose how we want to die, is how I would frame that.
Mm-hmm.
Our choice. And if you know, you want to go through chemotherapy, no, okay. Then what do? You have choices now. Mm-hmm. We have choices in the state of New Mexico and 11 other states in this country to make some choices. they're very individualized choices because one size does not fit all. And everyone's experiences can go from the traumatic to the sublime, and it all depends on the circumstances. Mm-hmm. But once we open the door to choice and let people know what those choices are and the compassionate choices that people can make, and I think that helps to pull back some fear.
I agree.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, and then the other point I wanted to make is that, you know, I don't know who was in the legislature in 2012 versus who was in the legislative seats in 2019 and 2021. You know, so sometimes it's who's your representative? Who are the lawmakers that are on your side and what their level of understanding is and how the constituents can get to those lawmakers?
Right.
You know, so there's a whole lot of, I mean, there's so many.
This time might not be as good a time as it was in 2021.
Right.
Yeah, for example.
You can't get a couch in when the door is closed. Basically, the door has to be open to move those big pieces of furniture.
And so this on-the-ground education, tabling, coming together and helping people understand what the choices are, mm-hmm. you know.
And one of the things we try to stress is the importance of advanced directives.
Oh, boy, howdy.
And talking about it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And Ellen Goodman started a project called Conversation Project a decade ago or so because when her mother died, she didn't know what her mother wanted. Her mother had dementia. It was too late to tell her. So she created this program. There are booklets with guidance and videos that you can watch on that. And what we use, we have a Compassion and Choices decision booklet that goes through a lot of what's needed. And what I'm hoping to do is have the volunteers work with helping people with advanced directives.
It's a great place to start.
I think so, too. I think if we're going to help protect what you're saying, and I think very compellingly as an individual right, putting people in the driver's seat with maximum agency well in advance of their death to be able to articulate exactly what they would like to see happen is an important foundation stone in protecting someone's right to die the way they choose to die.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the law caught up with that in some ways, and there may have been an opportune time in 2021. You know, the right mm-hmm. people were in
right
case.
People.
But I think also there was some persistence there. There were some attempts that, you know, didn't make it across, but we learned from those attempts coming back and coming back and coming back. But I think, you know, where we are in this country in many ways is we do protect an individual's right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, however that is. We you know, it's enshrined in many of our laws. So if we put an individual, we encourage an individual to optimize that agency by planning. In some ways, it kind of aligns us with who we are ethically as a country, and maybe some, you know, that's one way to broaden the conversation or push the envelope, for lack of another way of saying
it. In order to plan, they need to know the options.
Right.
And hospice, I think sometimes people think if you go to hospice, you've given up.
Yeah.
And it's often, I guess, apparently finally get into hospice when it's too late. Like my father, maybe the week before he died, he got into hospice.
Mm-hmm.
Another issue is voluntary stopping eating and drinking, an
mm-hmm.
option. And that is something that can be done, but it's not easy. You need a team of people to work with you. But I've seen videos about it. I know that one of our volunteers was a team member with a friend of ours who used medical aid in dying. But like you say, you have to plan. VSED Handbook is a little book that we looked at, and it was written by a woman whose mother had dementia or Alzheimer's, whatever, and she didn't want to live through the end of it, and she did not want to go to a nursing home or anything. And so it took probably years to plan it, but it took a lot of work, but it was successful. And the volunteer that was there was surprised how good it was. It wasn't a negative thing. I think it's more difficult on the family than it is on the patient.
And V said, for our listeners who might not be aware, is voluntarily stopping eating and drinking for someone who may not qualify for medical assistance in dying, but who has made a decision to die the way they wish to. They can choose, you know, to refuse food, drink, and medication other than palliative medication at the end of their life, which is a different way of, you know, you basically die of dehydration,
mm-hmm.
ultimately. But it strikes me, you know, hearing us speak this morning that, you know, what we're really dealing with is an ancestral burden. the legacy burden. So when we come up against the idea of, okay, well, we can't talk about this because this is the way it always has been, and there's this kind of acceptance that these are my choices, and the choices I have are yes or no. So the whole idea of end-of-life options, New Mexico, is to broaden agency, it seems to me, at the point of death. So, and that is where I think the organization aligns with something that's a uniquely American ethic. It's, I wish to have freedom of choice when it comes to where I worship, you know, what my political candidates are. And we're broadening to the touchy conversation now of how I choose to end my life. But it seems to me that presenting it in terms of an option and creating legislation that protects those options may take time, you know, and it, I think patience and persistence are certainly bywords in that. But I think that may be the way to get this done. And looking at our neighbors, you know, who are, you know, a little bit more liberal, as you said, in Canada, for example, to include neurological suffering, just to broaden the conversation so people have access to choices. And I think, you know, working out from under some of these legacy burdens we have about the idea of death needing to be a certain way, needing to be a terrifying thing, needing to involve suffering, you know, as opposed to entering it with a mode of choice and consciousness, which is, this is how I choose to go because I'm genuinely curious, as we talked about in our last month's program, about what's actually happening on the other side here. Mm-hmm. And if I'm bound up in fear about this process, my ability to imagine what's next for me may be a little bit hamstrung.
Suffering isn't just pain either.
No.
That is not the highest reason that people choose medical aid dying.
Yeah.
I mean, if a person just is miserable and is not terminal, and they see no purpose in life, and they're suffering because they can't do anything. I mean,
such as a person who had a really bad stroke. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Adrian. You have a thought right there.
ALS or dementia, you may have, well, if you do voluntary stopping eating and drinking to help yourself die, that's something, but it's not as nice as medical aid and dying is.
With medical aid and dying, you get to pick the date, the time.
And you get to celebrate it with your family and friends. I've heard of all kinds of stories of people, the way people celebrate it. And
that's one of the advantages, is that people know.
You get to say goodbye.
When you were with your mom, did you have a sense of fear that she was, when she was dying? Did you feel frightened, or you said you had relief that she was no longer suffering this terrible pain?
No, I don't think I had fear. I mean, I knew she was going to die and that she was ready. One of the things I did was I had her address book so that I could let all her contacts know that she had died. In fact, right now I have at least three friends that from high school that I don't know if they're alive, because I haven't heard from them, and they may not be alive. So, you know, I was able to let all her friends know what happened. And so, no, I didn't fear it.
It's like she opened a door for you. Moms do that in so many ways, even unto death, open doors for one another. How lucky she was to have you there, Adrian.
And Adrian's opening doors for young women in, you know, STEM careers and Expanding Horizons conferences. Question for you along of what Mary was asking is, did helping with your mom's death change your view of your own in terms of how you see it coming, or what's your sense of it now? Has the work you've done help you with your own end of life?
Well, I'm not afraid of it. My problem is if my husband dies first, that will be a big change. Whereas if my mother died, when she died, it wasn't a big change in my life because I had my own life, just miss her. So that's something that I do worry about. What am I going to do if I'm alone?
Right. That's, well, you have community
huge.
Around you,
yeah.
That's for sure. So what are you curious about when it comes to death? What questions do you ponder?
You mean if I don't die first?
Or just about death in general.
But your own death, your
about
own
your
passing.
Own death, your own coming to this border.
Well, I'm hoping that I don't suffer. I mean, you know, I will have people that can help me.
You will.
And if I am suffering. I would hope that I could use medical aid in dying. Mm-hmm. The number of people that use medical aid in dying is not a huge number as far as the portion of the state. So it's not something that I don't think has expanded a lot. Oh, over 660. Seems about 20 a week. There are 30 in the last time in 5 weeks. And it comes in spurts, well, at least mm-hmm. for Tawana. Mm-hmm. But,
who will be on this program next month? Yes. She's one of the medical care providers and who is an advocate for that. I'm hearing a really clear portrait emerge and having listened to you for a while, Adrian. I mean, you've inherited some of your mom's no-nonsense attitude about get on with it. I think there's a piece of what I've learned from working with you and will continue to learn from working with you is death is a part of life. It is a part of life that needs to be discussed, prepared for, advocated for. It is not separate from the process of living, so it needs to be included as we live. And in your typical kind of, I would say, no-nonsense, straight-up approach to doing this, you got a law passed that changed the fate of people suffering throughout mm-hmm. this state. And I think, honestly, will have a ripple effect elsewhere. I mean, for example, as you said earlier, people in neighboring states who don't have access to medical assistance in dying are now coming to New Mexico care of that. Mm-hmm. So I know Mary and I look up to you in more ways than one, just taking our, tipping our caps to what you've accomplished. And every person who appears in this program will be learning from their example. One question I'm going to ask everyone at the end of the show, because we're coming up near the end. Is there anything you wish we'd asked you?
I could go on talking forever on this topic. I mean, this is my life, unfortunately. It has overtaken me, and I do want to try to let go. And now that I have so many wonderful volunteers, having them take over some mm-hmm. of the stuff.
Okay. Delegate. Grow. Thank you so much for being here.
Yes. Thank you, Scott Plate and Adrian Dare. I'm so pleased that you're here. Adrian has been with End of Life Options New Mexico. You can go to that website to get more information. Scott Plate is co-producing this segment of Tuesday Morning Beat with me, Beyond the Border.